From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The warring parties in Yemen have apparently agreed to a humanitarian pause in the fighting in their country. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said he's looking forward to all sides respecting the unconditional humanitarian pause beginning this weekend to allow aid agencies to reach millions of people on the brink of famine. The pause involves ensuring full and unhindered access to all parts of the country, including seaports and airports. Deanne Penn reports from the United Nations.
The humanitarian pause will begin just before midnight on Friday, the 10th of July, and will go through the end of Ramadan 1 week later. Yemen is among the world's most pressing humanitarian emergencies, with 80% of the population, or 21 million people, in need. During the break in hostilities, UN agencies and their partners will deliver essential medicines, vaccinations, food, and water. They also plan to stockpile supplies throughout the country, including food for over 1 million people for a month. The UN Secretary General said it is imperative that humanitarian aid can reach all vulnerable people. Mr. Ban said the UN envoy for Yemen has received assurances from the rebels, the General People's Congress, and other parties that the pause will be fully respected. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
The UN Secretary General also thanked Yemen's fugitive ex-president, Abdrabu Mansour Hadi, who communicated his acceptance of the hiatus in fighting to the coalition from his sanctuary in Saudi Arabia. The heads of the self-proclaimed Donetsk and Luhansk republics in eastern Ukraine have asked the United Nations Security Council to establish an international tribunal to investigate and prosecute war crimes in Donbas. RT's Murad Gazdiev filed this report from Donetsk.
After thousands of people killed, even more missing and injured, and a million people even more perhaps forced to flee from their homes, it's indeed a pretty grisly picture. And to that effect, the two self-proclaimed republics here in the east want the UN to put together a special war crimes tribunal to investigate crimes against humanity committed by Ukrainian forces. Kiev also blames the dissidents, anti-government fighters, for carrying out their own war crimes. But the anti-government fighters here in the east have begun putting together, gathering what they say is evidence that will stand up in court, proving the guilt of Ukrainian forces. And they actually listed a number of examples. They pointed out that Ukrainian forces are all too happy to use inhumane and banned munitions, such as white phosphorus, contact with which generally leads to a painful and unavoidable death. Also, they listed that infamous air raid on Lugansk in the middle of the day. A missile fell in the middle of the city, killing 8 people, injuring even more civilians. Similar air raid in Kondrashovka, up to 10 people killed there. Again, more civilians injured. But they also went into the somewhat murky territory of unmarked mass graves. Of course, no way of telling just how many of them there are here and how many bodies they may hold.
U.S. President Barack Obama has reportedly said the chances of a deal on Iran's nuclear program are less than 50%. That despite the optimistic assurances from diplomats actually taking part in the ongoing marathon talks in Vienna.
We've come very close to reaching an agreement, not a preliminary, but a final, comprehensive deal. It is already within our reach.
We are moving forward. We entered into the most difficult and sensitive part of the talks.
There will need to be some difficult decisions made on both sides if we're going to get this done. But I think there is a clear will on both sides now to complete this agreement.
RT's Gayan Shchikayan has more.
Over drinks at the White House, President Obama told Senate Democrats that the chances of completing the deal with Iran at this point are less than 50-50%. Lawmakers who attended this working cocktail party say the president spoke a lot about Iran, trying to reassure the lawmakers that he will not sign a bad deal. You know, there are a lot of people in the U.S. Congress who don't want this deal to happen at all. Their pessimism seems to have rubbed off on President Obama. In April, when the framework agreement was announced, President Obama sounded different.
The United States, together with our allies and partners, has reached a historic understanding with Iran.
Now he puts the chances of a deal at less than 50-50. So what happened between now and a few months ago? 47 senators wrote to Iran's supreme leaders to say, don't trust our president. The next one can scrap the deal in a second. Given the mutual mistrust, Iran and the U.S. could not agree on the pace at which the sanctions would be lifted. U.S. lawmakers voted to be able to weigh in on the deal if it is signed. But mind you, even if the lawmakers don't like the deal, they couldn't really kill it because the president can veto whatever the lawmakers decide. But it would once again show how fragile this deal is.
The managing director of the International Monetary Fund has now joined the call by Athens for restructuring Greece's massive debt. Christine Lagarde said Greece is in a situation of acute crisis that needs to be addressed seriously and promptly. She said that restructuring can help make Greece's debt more sustainable. Lagarde said the IMF is fully engaged to help find a solution to the crisis. Meanwhile, Greece's finance minister said the country's banks will remain closed until Monday and that the 60 euro per day ATM withdrawal limits will remain in force until then. That announcement came as Athens works out the details of a new proposal to present to its international creditors that was due late Thursday. Press TV's Konstantin Venizelos was in Athens Thursday and filed this report.
A clear connection emerged on Wednesday between the IMF and the Greek government. Some call it an alliance. We wouldn't go as far. We insist on calling it a temporary connection. So the IMF and the Greek government now insist on a debt restructuring being an integral part of any upcoming agreement. And we know that at the moment, Germany is not changing its tune regarding the matter. German officials and ECB officials also are refusing to give any leeway to the Greek side regarding debt relief, or in simpler terms, a haircut of a third, at least a third, of the country's debt, as Christine Lagarde and the IMF now suggest. Of course, we have spent the last 10 days explaining why the IMF has been saying that Greece's debt is unsustainable, non-serviceable. And of course, the Prime Minister spent the best part of the last 2 days liaising with both the US President Barack Obama and Treasury Chief Jack Yu, asking them to weigh in on negotiations in Brussels and try to influence an agreement, point towards the direction of a debt restructuring deal as a matter of urgency. We don't know if these attempts will bear any fruit in the next 48 hours, but we certainly do know that Syriza will not be accepting a deal unless a debt relief, a debt haircut, we would like to call it, is on the cards for Greece. And we know that when the Greek side will be presenting its perhaps what will be a comprehensive plan of proposals. These will not divert too much from last week's and the week before that set of proposals from the Greek side, which include a package of reforms worth 8 billion euros. And of course, after that, Jean-Claude Juncker raised the bill to between 13 and 15 billion euros. So bearing in mind that Syriza will not really be essentially presenting anything new, except, of course, from a laid out plan of a plan of consumption is what the argument is here. European officials have been accusing Greece that it's not really presenting a plan of production, but rather a socialist plan of consumption. And that's the main difference here, really. European officials are expecting a fiscal strategy that goes 2-3 years into the future and sets fiscal targets that can be achieved with certain reforms. And we know that at the moment, the Greek government is not in a position to actually draft such a plan, having, you know, made out some baby steps into rolling austerity in Greece. So the core of the arguments, as you see, is still in place. And of course, unless there is a haircut for Greece or a severe compromise on behalf of Greece, we can't really see an argument emerging either on Friday's Eurogroup or 2 days later during the EU summit.
As we reported earlier, this week saw the Russian city of Ufa play host to two major summits, the summit of the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. One of the subjects under discussion at the seventh summit of the heads of state and government of the BRICS member states is the establishment of the much-anticipated BRICS Development Bank, seen by many as an alternative to Western-dominated financial institutions such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. On Tuesday, the central banks of the BRICS countries officially agreed to invest $100 billion in a joint currency pool. That was in addition to the $50 billion of banking and investment capital that was previously announced by the group to be earmarked for loans for large-scale joint projects in transportation, information and energy infrastructure, and industrial development. The bank will begin approving investment projects in the first quarter of 2016. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or SCO, is a Eurasian political, economic, and military organization which was founded in 2001 in Shanghai by the leaders of China and Russia and the former Soviet republics of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. India, Iran, and Pakistan are expected to become full members shortly. Its current six full members account for 60% of the land mass of Eurasia, and its population is a quarter of the world's. Including its observer states, Afghanistan, India, Iran, Mongolia, and Pakistan, it accounts for about half of the world's population. And the potential for growth of these new rising structures is becoming clearer every day. In just one example, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro proposed Wednesday that the Bolivarian Alliance for the Peoples of America, or ALBA, a leftist bloc of Latin American and Caribbean countries, join the new BRICS bank, which is set to be fully functional by the end of this year. He pointed out that the structures being adopted very much resemble the structure proposed by his predecessor, former President Hugo Chavez, and other Latin American leaders for a Bank of the South in 2007.
I remember President Chavez, Correa, Lula, Néstor Kirchner. It's like I can hear them today saying that that was urgent to create a reserve fund of the South so we can bring all the capitals, all the wealth to take them to the region and create a new type of development bank. And both tools should work together, the reserve, strategic reserve fund and the Bank of the South. The elements are there. But now with the passing away of Néstor Kirchner and of Commander Chavez, when Lula left the presidency, all that had an impact on this project. But also, when you see the BRICS and how they are working, we need to go back to this project to reinvigorate it. So we need to join the BRICS as soon as we can, based on the bylaws of the bank, so the ALBA can join the Bank of the BRICS, so we can build the new financial architecture, a world financial architecture that we propose this new alternative to the IMF in the case of Europe that now are cornering Greece. Time has come for new things to impose themselves to, but we need to overcome the lack of political will. I think with the BRICS, what we are seeing is that they are speeding the decision. President Xi Jinping from China and President Putin from Russia and Dilma Rousseff from Brazil, Prime Minister from India, and presidents of South Africa. I think they are determined, and they are moving forward very quickly to strengthen this initiative. And then we are very optimistic by them.
The BRICS summit's final declaration was issued late Thursday. It called upon the UN Security Council to admit Brazil, South Africa, and India as permanent members. It also contained a statement condemning, quote, unilateral military interventions and economic sanctions in violation of international law and universally recognized norms of international relations, closed quote. For more on all of that, we spoke with journalist Dmitry Babich, senior editor at the Russian news agency Sputnik, who's been in Ufa this week attending both the BRICS and SCO summits. Tell us what's going on, first of all, in Ufa. You have two separate conferences going on that are very important.
Yes, we have the summit of BRICS, and we have the summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And the leaders of these two organizations are going to have a joint meeting later today, I guess. And to me, the most important thing is, you know, the context. Let's just remember what Mr. Obama said a few months ago, actually addressing the American nation. He said that Russia is, I quote, isolated, its economy in tatters. Okay, if being isolated means that you are visited by the presidents of China, India, South Africa, Brazil, Pakistan, you know, the prime minister of Pakistan is holding talks with the prime minister of India on your territory, right. Then I want this isolation. I would call this isolation splendid. I wish Mr. Obama the same kind of isolation. This is the main message that that is coming from Ufa. You know, people representing 30% of the world's economy and 40% of the world's population are now meeting in Russia, and this is very important. And what I would also like to point out is that, you know, when G7 says, "Oh, you know, we are so much more civilized, we are so much more important." And BRICS, you have some not very democratic countries there. Okay, maybe some of these countries are not democratic in the way, you know, in the way Mr. Cameron or Mr. Obama would acknowledge it. But at least none of these countries supports a war outside its borders. Basically, if you look at the way Saudi Arabia, with American support, is now waging a war in Yemen. In Syria, we know who started the civil war and who supplied weapons and money to the so-called Syrian opposition, which later founded the Islamic State. Libya is still in shambles, and there is a civil war going there after there was the Western intervention. So none of these countries started wars outside its territories, at least during the last 20 years. And my question is, who should be teaching whom? Should it be G7 teaching BRICS, or should it be BRICS actually teaching G7? Well, actually, BRICS does not want to teach anyone. They adopted a very mild declaration as a result of the summit, which calls for an agreement on the Iranian nuclear program, an agreement on lifting sanctions against Iran. It calls for a diplomatic solution to the civil war in Ukraine. It praises Russia for starting a dialogue between the Syrian government and the Syrian opposition on the territory of Russia. Unfortunately, in the United States and the EU, their position is just that their guys in Syria should win, and that will solve all the problems. I don't think it's going to be the case. So BRICS is not teaching G7. G7 is teaching BRICS, but what are the successes that G7 can really boast about?
Well, let's see. For example, their respect for democracy, at least those members that are members of the EU, lead them to condemn a vote, an historic vote, really, in Greece. One of the first times that people were asked, in essence, do you want a condition of austerity and privatization or not? And the Greek people said no. And the members of the G7 that are also members of the EU and their allies are looking at that askance. They're looking at it as if it's something to be ignored.
Well, they say that it's a tragedy for the Greek people, you know, that this is something that will hamper Greece's development. This is strange for a club of democratic nations. And again, none of the members of this great democratic club, the G7, had the guts to suggest asylum to Edward Snowden, who, as it is now acknowledged by the press inside the G7 countries, who actually exposed some very undemocratic and illegal activities of the National Security Agency, something that the Soviet regime was frequently accused, of doing that, eavesdropping on your own citizens. And none of these countries had the guts to suggest asylum to Mr. Snowden. Somehow these backsliding on democracy, these nations backsliding on democracy, China and then Russia gave Snowden asylum.
Maybe for our audience, most of them don't know what the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is about. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes, well, Shanghai Cooperation Organization consists of six countries now. I think most important, India and Pakistan have started procedures to join that organization. They're going to join in 2016. And I think that's a major achievement because when hostile states join a certain international organization, this is a very good safeguard against an unwanted war. Greece and Turkey, when they joined NATO, I think it was an achievement. I mean, I can criticize NATO now, but I don't want to be unobjective with history. There were periods when first all of the Western civilization was very different, when it was indeed leading the way, and there were periods when NATO was indeed needed and played a constructive role. Currently, Shanghai Cooperation Organization may play the same role for India and Pakistan which NATO played for Greece and Turkey. If India and Pakistan become members of this organization, if they sign 28 documents which the membership requires, it will be very hard for them to unleash hostile actions against each other. And let me remind you that Pakistan has 120 nuclear devices. India has even more. And until recently, if there was any major danger in Asia, major threat, it was a threat of a military conflict between India and Pakistan.
Yeah. And I mean, they've been hostile since Pakistan seceded from India after the British were kicked out. There's been several.
Exactly, in 1947. And, when the British patriots or whatever you call them, when they say that the British Empire did not collapse in tears, well, this is simply not true because tears followed later when India and Pakistan had a war in 1965, when millions of people had to change, to flee their native towns and cities in 1947, 1948. When there was another India-Pakistani war in 1971, in the same way, when people say that the Soviet Union collapsed peacefully, again, this is only partially true because what we see now in Ukraine is a direct consequence of the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was badly managed, badly organized, which was not allowed to heal itself, primarily by the Western powers, which instead of fostering good relations between Russia and the former Soviet republics, did everything to alienate Russia and to start conflicts between Russia and its former Soviet compatriots, namely Ukraine, Georgia, and other countries of the former Soviet Union.
Right. That's still ongoing, obviously, the actual war that's taking place in Ukraine. There's joint maneuvers apparently scheduled between the U.S., NATO, and Georgia. And, of course, there's...
And U.S. and Ukraine also in Western Ukraine for the end of July.
Right. So, let's talk about that. So what's going to be happening with the U.S. military in Ukraine while this war that Kiev is conducting on the east continues?
Well, first, let me just remind you that there are 300 American instructors still teaching Ukrainian, not even Ukrainian soldiers, but Ukrainian paramilitaries from the so-called National Guard battalions. And these are not professional military. These are nationalist activists who took part in the Maidan so-called revolution, who threw Molotov cocktails in police at the time, killing 13 policemen. There were not just losses on the side of the demonstrators in the last day, you know, when some mysterious group of people started shooting. Before that, 13 policemen were killed. I can imagine what would happen in the United States if a group of so-called peaceful demonstrators killed 13 policemen. Basically, there are 300 U.S. instructors teaching these people to lead a war. And at the same time, we hear from the United States and from the EU that there is no military solution to this conflict. So somehow diplomats say one thing and military instructors do quite a different thing. And of course, this is not passing unnoticed in Russia, and this is not passing unnoticed for countries like China and India. I think the fact that the leaders of China, India, South Africa, Pakistan, the fact that they agreed to come to Russia at the moment when Mr. Obama is clearly trying to isolate Russia, this is a mild sign of disagreement with American policy. This is a message which they want to send to the United States and to the EU. We are not quite happy with your policy. We don't agree. We may not be willing to start confrontation with you. And this was reflected in the statement of BRICS adopted today. We don't want to have confrontation with anyone. We don't see enemies anywhere, but we would like to suggest our solutions, which are clearly very different from the solutions suggested by the United States, by the EU, and by the G7.
You know, and BRICS isn't just limited, in terms of membership it is, but BRICS isn't just limited to Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. For example, Brazil goes back to Latin America. When Rousseff goes back, they're part of a number of regional projects of integration, both economic and political. And that entire group essentially has a foot in BRICS, which is essentially which is essentially the entire Western Hemisphere, except for the United States and Canada and perhaps Mexico, although that may be changing too.
And this is not the only case when a BRICS member speaks for the whole region. Besides the Indian Prime Minister, we also hosted today in Russia the Iranian President, right, Hassan Rouhani. It's funny that the Western press does not report on the summit in Ufa. I mean, I switched on the French television, the British television today, and they reported on all kinds of things, you know, like demonstrations in Nicaragua, all kinds of disasters. But they didn't report that the presidents of Iran, Brazil, and, you know, China and a dozen other important countries are actually meeting in Russia. They don't think it was worth reporting it. But let me tell you, India is a part of South Asia. And South Asia, it is more or less dependent on neighboring countries such as Iran. So BRICS, indeed, you're quite right. You know, these people are not speaking just for their countries, big as they are. They're speaking for whole regions. And it's a travesty that, for example, the Indian Prime Minister can sit at the same table with the president of Iran. But we haven't yet had a direct contact and a direct negotiation between the president of the United States and Iran.
Right.
It is simply strange, you know, and you can see watching the summit in BRICS who is trying to split the people of the world, who is unwilling to talk to other people as if they were, you know, blacks in the United States of the 19th century, as if they were somehow inferior, anthropologically inferior to the great leaders of the Western world.
Yeah. I mean, you would think it would be newsworthy in the U.S. that when U.S. policy is to isolate Russia, that the president of the country with the world's largest economy is meeting with the president of Russia and others, and opening a bank, by the way, together.
You can put these facts together, and this is the journalist's job. He should keep it in his memory. Here's what Mr. Obama said. Here is what happened today. Mr. Obama said that Russia is isolated and Russia is hosting a summit of nations representing 40% of the world's population and 30% of the world's economy. Draw your conclusion.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.